Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
So it's May 2020. What can I say? This is not our usual setting for this podcast. Camilla, I understand you've got the blue flashing light of the NHS light on the top of the shard.
I have.
From your window.
I'm going into styling for podcasts, I've decided. And I've got the shard in front of me, which every night is going into its NHS blue tribute. And on the other side in the daylight, I've got the garden that someone in my household is fostering.
And Keith, you've managed to keep all the farmhands at bay. No one's going to come bursting in asking you why they haven't been paid this week or anything like that, are they?
I'm here in Wales, sat in my office here looking out at the garden. And I'm not a gardener, you know. I've been described in the past as being a slash and burn merchant, but we've been doing a lot of work, and to be honest, it's been quite good. But I have to say, I'm tired with a capital K.
Is that kaput?
Yeah, well, it is. I'm absolutely knackered.
He puts it so well. We're about a month into lockdown. We are obviously talking in this way because of the coronavirus outbreak. We can't meet together because of social distancing issues. So therefore, this is the way that we're going to be recording our podcast. I'm in North London. I'm on the rat run between Whittington Hospital and Barnet General Hospital. So we get a good sense of people that are being whisked from hospital to hospital at the moment with frequent sirens. And it does bring it all home, doesn't it? And we're here, obviously, to talk about the effect that the virus has had on the charity sector. Keith, Camilla, you've been talking to the chief execs that you deal with and those running charities. What is the picture that they're painting at the moment?
Tough times out there. You know, they've got a big challenge, the chief execs, and they're trying to keep themselves safe, their staff safe. They've got a mixture of people who are either on furlough, some that are working, and others they've unfortunately had to make redundant. Some of them can't get hold of the PPE that they need, but a lot of them have had to stop all their group sessions and obviously try and go on a one-to-one basis. So it's not easy. The staff are, at times, very challenged in delivering in a new way.
I think it is about either shrinking or expanding. So, for example, you've got something like the Borough Market, which is a charity which provides a necessary need. Its tourist industry, gone.
Yeah.
But its local provision is still there, really interestingly becoming what it started out maybe 20, 25 years ago as a neighbourhood retail market. But equally, it's also expanded because when there was a massive donation given for fruit and veg to go to the local guys in Thomas's Hospital, who could provide that but the Borough Market? Now, on the other side, you've got the funders. Those funders who can have done exactly what they did after other disasters like Grenfell or like any of the terrorism incidents. They became light-footed, shall we say, very, very quick, called in all their markers, linked to all their communities, and responded quickly in a way that is, I won't say putting the government to shame, but they did a much better job.
Yeah. Fortunately, the positive bit that's come out of it is some of the grant aid bodies have actually come up trumps. Moondance, for instance, is just one that has helped a lot of the charities down here with swift grants. They've just turned the grants around in a couple of days, if not sooner, and also got the money in their banks. That's made it a lot easier for some of the charities to continue with the work.
There is the statistic, which is really quite shocking, that only a quarter of charities in the UK, it's estimated, have reserves to last for 3 months, which ultimately is, I suppose, what we're talking about. And it really just points up the fact that I dare say that a lot of charities, the cash flow situation for people running charities is always right on the margins. And suddenly a shock like this is going to push them into the quagmire, as it were.
And aside from that, you've got a really odd timing issue, if I can put it that way. It has come in just at a time when most charities would be finalising their budgets. They would have set up their strategic plans for the next year, the next 2 years, maybe even the next 5 years. Literally in March, they turned all their budget figures upside down, inside out. They're looking at either a shrinkage of 30, 40, 50, sometimes 70, 80%. They don't know, if you like, what even to do about their budgeting. If they have any reserves and are lucky enough, they can do a little bit of budgeting. Maybe 6 months down the line, they're thinking, we don't know what's going to happen. So do we even draw up another budget? Do we suspend all our strategies, whatever income we have? What do we do? So charities in that way are just exactly like the rest of us. They don't know exactly what to do at this moment. So they've gone from kind of shock and awe. The shock has kind of faded slightly. The awe is still there.
Yeah. And in a way, viruses are no respecter of the financial year, are they, basically?
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and the longer this goes on, the more difficult it's going to be for the charities. And I'm sad to say, I think some won't survive it. And some of the bigger charities are actually struggling because they've used to rely on income. Now, income, obviously, since they've closed the doors, has dried up. And some that were, you know, asset rich, that were running big operations, but cash poor, have really suffered. You need to remember that charities that are now delivering a lot of the services that previously local governments delivered, you know, that those that came out of compulsory competitive tendering or outsourcing, are actually delivering to the community exactly what was there before.
Ah.
Well, that gives us a very good cue to introduce our guest for this week. She was also a guest on a previous episode of the podcast not that long ago, and it's incredibly timely that she's back, as it were. But Alex Scales from the Centre for Charity Effectiveness at Cass Business School also joins us. She's in sunny Suffolk.
Hello, delighted to be here.
And I guess you've been trying to work out a way to give some words of encouragement, solace, trying to look forward as to how things are going to be panning out for people running charities. But just before we talk about that, about the future, and trying to sort of read the runes, as it were, tell us just some of the stories, some of the people that have been telling you their stories about what's going on and about what they're having to endure.
Yeah, as Camilla said, I mean, gosh, where to start? Because it is so very, very varied, you know, representing the huge diversity across the sector. Obviously, it's really, really tough for many, many organisations. They've got such huge increases in the demands for their services, and they're hemorrhaging cash, and they're looking at their income levels have already plummeted, and they can't see when they will begin to pick up or what the new norm's going to look like. But equally, we're seeing some that are relatively untouched and are using this period to kind of hunker down and really focus on what they might emerge from this crisis looking like, and really taking that time to invest. I think we're seeing quite a lot of tensions coming through. We're seeing tensions that have always existed with boards and management teams, but in terms of what's in the best interest of the organisation versus what's in the best interest of the beneficiaries. So those decisions being taken, really tough decisions about whether to furlough, who to furlough, when to furlough, who to let go. That's no different to any other sector, but that passion, that shared passion for a cause within charities, I think makes those decisions even harder. And we're hearing that it's not a sprint, but a marathon. But I hosted just another leader's breakfast this morning, and they are all just running so fast. And they're wondering how they're going to keep running at that pace over the course of what looks likely to be a marathon.
And it's strange, isn't it? You mentioned marathon there, and one of the first stories that came out of this was, oh my goodness me, the London Marathon is going to be cancelled. There's 55 million quid's worth of money that is not going to be coming into the hands of the charities. And that was almost the first sort of realisation for the charity sector that there was going to be something dramatic was happening. And I was quite struck by the fact that it took quite a while before the government confirmed that charities were in that position, didn't it? I was quite surprised. It was a good 3 days after the initial announcement from Rishi Sunak that charities could apply for furloughing.
Part of it is still, though, about how much they can actually get from some of the grants that are going around. The good thing that in some charities that the community spirit out there has actually helped them, that where, you know, local people are trying to come to the fore. And that obviously just says how people support charities in the sort of challenging times.
What's your view, Alex, on how sort of government has been listening to charities, as it were?
They have been slow. I think perhaps there was an assumption there that for the mid-tier and larger charity organisations, they are registered companies as well. So perhaps an underlying assumption that they'd be able to access the same resources and opportunities that were being offered to small and medium-sized businesses and enterprises. I don't think it was particularly helpful, you know, when the Chancellor talked about the people needing the niceties of charity at this time, when he announced the 750 million. I think a lot of the work the charities are doing right now is hard, it's gritty, it's expert, it's professional services. And it is really impossible to deliver with such reduced income levels.
You've also got the huge issues around volunteers and all the people who support these charities with, if you like, no thanks but virtue. And they're either social distancing or they're self-isolating.
Exactly right. In fact, just to build on that, we've got a clip, which I'll just drop in now, from Esther Ransom, founder of Childline, saying exactly that on a recent edition of Broadcasting House on Radio 4.
It's not just paid employees who are furloughed. One of the tragedies of the charity sector is that an awful lot of volunteers have had to self-isolate themselves because they're 70 plus. We've lost something like 60% of the Childline volunteer counsellors because they're 70 plus. I think we need to recognise that our charities across the board have been supported by the older generation in the work they do and, of course, the fundraising they do. And spare a thought for all those crucial services which I think are now suffering. So it isn't only paid employees who are having to furlough, it's also some of our volunteers.
One of the things that I find really interesting is the language around all of this and the things that people are doing to keep themselves, if you like, up. And it is all about creativity. And I'm doing this, I'm learning a musical instrument, I'm cooking, I'm gardening. All of those things are the same sort of language that retirees use. And I'm just thinking of the retiree and the volunteer and how much we depend on people who have flexible time.
Well, of course, that's the other thing. And, you know, all those different charities serving different purposes. And I noticed Keith's Labradors have just come into our Welsh studio, have just made an appearance. So
the Welsh, you know, Labradors.
They're clearly in much need. But you look at all the different charities. I mean, it does focus the mind that a lot of this sort of focus has been on actually just caring for the elderly and feeding people. And ultimately, we are looking at some very basic charitable needs that are having to be satisfied in all of this. And one does worry that around the edges, you know, the niceties of very tightly focused charities may lose out somewhat because this is where everyone is looking.
Yeah, I think there is a real challenge for charities now going forward. It's certainly the smaller ones, because some of them just won't survive. I think that's true. But maybe that it will be a time where some of the charities can look to partner up with other people, to merge with other charities. You know, we've got 160,000 charities in the country at the moment. I will be surprised once we get through this epidemic if we've got the same number that are out there.
Taking up Keith's point before about speaking for the charity sector, Alex, do you think that in this sort of situation, even though it's a disaster and everybody's firefighting, that somehow you have to be out there lobbying with a capital L just to get noticed? In other words, the loud shouters will get the squeaky wheel oiled, if I'm not mixing my metaphors.
I think it's really difficult because, you know, we used to have a minister for charities that's now been absorbed within DCMS.
Yep.
You know, obviously there are a lot of umbrella organisations. They are working together, the key ones, to take their voice to Commons committees and the like. But at the moment, I can't hear anyone really shouting and structuring a sound argument without it making it sound as if they're a special case. I mean, there is so much suffering going on across all sectors in different shapes and forms.
Keith?
I think that's right. I think that we have to look forward to some of the national bodies that are there for the charities just to make sure they are making the right contacts in government, making the right arguments, you know, talking to the grant aiders, which there are a lot out there, and God bless them, you know, we love them dearly in the charity sector, but making sure that they're going to now focus on the exit strategies that some of these charities are going to have to get involved in very quickly.
I don't know exactly where this fits in, but I'm going to say this anyway. Really interesting making a list of income streams for a charity, big or small. Property, commercial, residential, or A3. Investments, with or without a fund. Dividends, endowment funds, fundraising via events, like David, you mentioned the marathon. They rent out their own facilities, for example, to get income. Donations, ticket sales from art for the arts. Not one of those is untouched, and untouched in a major way. So you think about, you know, I hate the word niceties around the sector. This is tough, tough, tough. And this is real, real, real. And each one of those sectors that I've mentioned is going to have its income cut. Yes, there are big picture things, but the charity sector is part of that big picture.
Those different income streams are really useful to focus on, because for so long, the sort of charity commission guidance around reserves policies and amounts that should be held have been debated and scrutinised. And I think it's underscoring even more now that organisations and their boards have to have a real understanding not only of their organisation's expenditure, so this sort of popular myth that you should hold 3 or 6 months of your expenditure so you can have an orderly closure should push come to shove. But the fact that there needs to be a real understanding of the risk profile of your different income streams. Now, obviously, no one would have foreseen where we currently are today, and no one would have been able to store up sufficient reserves, nor should they have done, because that would have meant they wouldn't have been spending on their actual cause. But I think it is interesting, and perhaps might create a different debate longer term in terms of those who perhaps used to bash quite hard charities who hold significant amount of reserves. There's no right or wrong, but, you know, some of them are going to be in a better position having thought through their reserves policies a little bit more in depth and with more clarity than those who've just put away 3 months' reserves for no particular reason.
Yep.
How prepared do you think some of the people running charities in the UK are, though? I mean, you know, some of them have probably come through your ranks at the Cass Business School, Alex, but generally, how much expertise is there out there in this level of crisis management and leading organisations through these sort of times?
Well, I mean, you know, as you can hear me saying it over and over again, the diversity in terms of size of organisation is absolutely immense. And obviously, that's going to vary significantly. I think those who have invested in their board governance and taken heed from the noise that has been around improving governance and what best practice might look like, whether you're a very small community organisation or a much larger organisation, I think those will inevitably be better positioned, particularly if they've looked at the sort of skills sitting around that board table.
And from a chief exec's point of view, from a chair of the board, you know, policy, strategy, monitoring, you know, the scrutiny role, all the HR issues there are around managing staff and managing, more importantly, I guess, managing volunteers, are all the sort of skills that charities need to have within their portfolio.
Yeah, what we're seeing as well in terms of boards and, in fact, senior management teams is the different headspace individuals are in terms of looking at the length of the timeline over which this is going to play out. And that both chairs and chief execs are having real difficulty trying to get people in the same place in terms of mindset to look forward. And that's causing quite a few tensions, albeit, you know, additionally exasperated by the fact that everything's being done online, you know, online board meetings, online senior management meetings, etc.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, Keith and Alex, because I've heard, if you like, something different, where a charity that had been through a particular disaster in the last few years had therefore, if you like, got all its back of house organized. It knew where its logistics were in its warehouse, not literally, but its board had turned around and said to its chief exec and senior team, "You've done this before. You did it brilliantly. We totally support you. We stand back. You get on with it. Tell us what you need." The beginning of this year's 5-year plan is now next year, So the mindset, the way of thinking of that board is aligned with the chief exec and the senior team, and everybody feels supported and in an extraordinary way, as busy as they are, kind of relaxed.
I've had a conversation today with one of my charity chief execs who have said they've had to now put their staff on home working, which actually some of them saying, I never joined to be a call centre operator. But that's how they feel that they're acting at the moment. But you're right, the situation is that the whole charity sector, I'm sure, will have to refocus on their exit strategy to say, what will good look like going forward? You know, there was one of the big entrepreneurs this week said he feels that the high street will never be the same again. And I think we're looking at a situation where charities will be operating in a different way going forward.
And some slightly chilling words from the Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, at the DCMS committee a few days ago, saying we can't save every charity. I mean, that is a sort of little bit of a wake-up call, isn't it, for those who were thinking, well, I'm sure the government will find a way of giving us a handout to keep us going.
Oh, there's not going to be bailouts for everyone, David. Oh, my God, no. And the other thing that's interesting is charities that are furloughing, as are businesses, will be looking at the end of this furloughing period to say, is this the point at which we restructure?
And I think it puts a really interesting slant on the sort of employer-employee relationships. There are going to be, you know, real tensions there in terms of bringing people back who were furloughed versus those that weren't. So there's going to be time needed to invest in building that top team again to carry the organisation forward. And that time really isn't there. So I think those who are most agile and able to adapt and embrace the change. Keith was just saying now about talking about what's your exit strategy. And for some, it will be better for them to think about that very, very carefully, I think.
Yeah, I think that it's a must, isn't it? I mean,
you've got to look at it on a household level, haven't you?
You do.
People who are working for charities. I don't want to sort of stereotype it, but it's quite often in a household, it may be the person who's not necessarily the prime earner or the secondary earner. There is pressure on that person potentially to be more looking, doing childcare or whatever it is. And so you're losing resource all the time. And as we know, furloughing only goes so far. I mean, it is amazing, actually, remarkable. Sometimes you look at some organisations like the National Trust, 80% of their staff have been furloughed, and similarly in some of the other big charities. It's an extraordinary rescue package that's been put together. And maybe we should also talk about the £750 million funding which is announced by the government, which is earmarked for the charity sector. Now, I'm not entirely clear whether that money is rescue package money or whether it's money for activity money. And we hear also that half of that, £375 million, is going to be distributed through the National Lottery, which implies that that is for activities rather than for rescue packages. When you saw that figure, that £750 million figure, Alex, did it surprise you? Did you think, well, that's not going to go very far? Or what was your general reaction to that?
My initial reaction was, thank goodness, and one of delight and pride that many of the people I'd been talking with and meeting with during the course of the week who'd been lobbying so hard had at least managed to achieve, well, not at least, but had achieved what has to be taken as a big success, going from naught to 750.
Absolutely.
Not a huge amount if you look at those estimates of losing 4.3 billion, I think it was, of income over the initial 12-month period. And at the same time, hearing chief execs who work in, poverty reduction, their demand's gone up 20 times. St John's Ambulance chief exec saying they'd recruited 5,000 volunteers over two weekends, you know, and at the same time, the income going down. And there are many, many others like it. Look at it in the overall scale of things, it is small. But when you think about what that might mean if it's distributed well to small community organisations who are doing so much work on the ground and can be very thrifty and productive of what they're given, then one would hope that some value will be created.
Another comment that was made to me by one of my charities was, actually, I can't apply for some of these grants because they say I'm not paying business
rates,
which is unfortunate, but it is another sort of fence they've got to try and get over within that. the pace of the delivery of the money is important, because it does mean that people can continue to tick over and help the community and help those people who need it. I mean, there's horrible figures coming out at the present moment in time about abuse and you know, the physical abuse in the home. One of my charities are full with all their respite care. So it's a balance.
But we've seen some great examples of collaborative working and barriers being broken down as people have reacted very quickly. And I think if anything good has come out of this awful situation, it is the fact that some barriers have been overcome and people are working together. I mean, just Children in Need and Comic Relief, you know, very separate initiatives that came together on the back of this and hopefully setting an example to others.
Camilla, did you want to just come in on the point about, you know, becoming smaller, the charity sector becoming smaller?
I'd rather talk really about, if you like, the values after this is over, if it's ever over, and how we don't just rely on the charities, and I know I'm always banging on about this, as the place that our ethics reside in. A lot of people in this incredibly shock and awe and awful situation have talked again and again about values. And one of the things that really interests me is, at the end of it all, do we revert to exactly what we did before because we're so desperate for what we call normality? Or is there going to be a new normal in which the charity sector as a whole, if you like, permeates or begin to permeate everything, in which we pay people better so that the charity sector doesn't have to underwrite things like food banks? When did food banks ever become normal?
So you're almost seeing it as a philosophical change of heart in society as a whole. And I dare say that fueling into that, we've had this sort of upswing, the clapping on a Thursday night, the sense of community spirit that perhaps we haven't had before. Do you think there is going to be a wholesale change in society? Government's responsibility will broaden much more. Other aspects of community will change?
I would love to think that, David. I think that the difficulty is that you're either going to go one way or the other.
There is one individual, isn't there, who sort of actually has kind of become the star of this in so many ways, internationally as well as nationally, and that's a gentleman who just came out to his 100th birthday and celebrated by walking up and down his lawn a few times and raised an extraordinary, well, a jaw-dropping amount of money.
Yes.
It is unbelievable, isn't it? Captain Tom.
Yes, and this is somebody who captured our imagination, obviously, because people gave either massive amounts or very tiny amounts in huge quantities, which meant that the millions literally kept, it was like one of those, you know, the church roof thermometers that you used to see a lot, where it used to be creep over many, many years. This didn't creep. It just shot up completely, bigger than the shard. And you think, well, if that's what really everybody feels, then how are things going to look different afterwards? And if I'm an optimist, I think things are going to look massively different. And if I'm a pessimist, which I'm not, I think everybody's going to revert to type and say, you know, how many things can I order on Amazon? And that's what's going to occupy me.
And potentially, I mean, you know, it's interesting you raise Amazon there, because I see that they've actually secretly given £250,000 to a fund to help booksellers to keep going, which, I mean, I suppose in a sense they've
had extraordinary,
a charitable heart. I haven't seen Jeff Bezos starting a charitable foundation yet. I don't know if you've heard anything, Alex, but you know, maybe maybe it will filter to those sort of individuals as well.
It'd be nice, wouldn't it? But I mean, just to go back to the point you were making in terms of, you know, civil society and raising awareness, you probably will have seen the sort of Nevermore Needed, hashtag Nevermore Needed campaign that charities, staff and leaders being asked to put out the good news stories and the tough stories in terms of what they're delivering to really generate that public awareness. And I think that's what I was saying when we all first met and I was connected with you. You know, there's just such a need to really raise that awareness in terms of the so many activities that charities do to support really hard causes that it's, as you say, have been passed often from local authorities into the hands of charities to deliver, and are going to be needed as much, if not more, than previously.
There are obviously some things that we will learn from this. The digital framework where people have now been working from home and how that works and whether you need actually better IT kit, which will make it easier to communicate and keep in contact. It means that some services will actually use less building costs because they will now deliver in a different way. They won't need the same size of building. So actually that may actually end up saving money, but putting more money into the service delivery, which I think is a real bonus.
It's quite interesting coming together and talking about these things and trying to do something very positive. And actually, it's probably quite a good time, Alex, to announce that the Centre for Charity Effectiveness at Cass Business School are officially now our partners in this podcast, which is fantastic news. And I think our aim over the next few episodes of the podcast is going to be to talk to some of the chief execs and those running charities and just getting a sense of how they're managing through this particular crisis, because it is so much in our minds and in everyone in the charity sector's minds at the moment, how on earth we get through this period, how on earth we come out the other side, which is what we've been talking about today.
I'm delighted to be involved in terms of working together in this, and we've touched on many issues that will really benefit from being shared more widely, not least the greater awareness in terms of what the challenges and the opportunities charities are dealing with, but also the many, many services that they are providing. I think through tough times are going to come learning, and I think this is a great opportunity to share learning, as you say, by drawing on all of our experiences in terms of the people and organisations that we're working with over the days of the week, but also bringing in those leaders of both large and small organisations who'll be able to share what they're doing.
I think the joy in everybody's voice on this podcast when we talk about the causes that we're involved in, the things that pull at our heart, that sort of joy, which a lot of people, ironically, are also experienced in this difficult time, I just like people to carry that over into the next life, whatever that life's going to be.
Gosh, Camilla, you're getting terribly physical. You've been locked up in the same room for quite too long, haven't you?
Time to think.
On that philosophical bombshell from Camilla McGibbon, I think we're all going to have to go and have our daily exercise.
Sounds good.
We will be back with some more very shortly. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. The website, if you want to check us out, it's goodcharitybadcharity.com. Please rate and review and tell your friends about this podcast, particularly if they're working in the charity sector. Feel free to email us through the website with any suggestions for guests or topics that you'd like us to discuss on Future Edition. Our thanks as ever to Dan Hardoon, to Whistledown Studios. From us all, a goodbye and stay safe.